Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. And Rosenbaum Media Group, a digital communications agency integrating high-definition video into PR, marketing, advertising, and social media campaigns. Big-picture thinking for local and national clients. RosenbaumMedia.com. From Northeast Public Radio, this is The Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score. Killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk. Pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, in the Media Project, we have something important to announce this week, that something big happened in Boston since our last show. But before we announce that, Ira Fussfeld is here, the publisher.
Hello.
The investigative journalist, Rosemary Armeo.
Hello.
And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. And we're here without the professor. Dr. Shartok is off somewhere gallivanting. Usually it's you, Rosemary, who's off somewhere else in the world.
I'm jealous. Yes.
Yeah.
Just
well.
Back from Brazil.
Brazil, yes. There was a journalism conference there and then a little side trip.
Just a little side trip.
Well, I'm just back from Port Ewan, so I just...
Almost the
it's
same.
It's a nice town. It's built up. It looks like very nice, but not quite the same as Brazil. They Carnavale in Port Ewan does not quite match.
Imagine. Yeah, and I'm in from Rensselaer County, where, you know, we always talk about the girl from Troy. Is it the girl from Ipanema?
You know, yes, dun, we... dun, dun, dun.
Anyway, so what big happened in Boston, folks? Yes, it's true. The purchase of the Boston Globe was official. John Henry has completed his purchase of the Boston Globe, Boston.com, the Worcester Telegram and Gazette, and the Telegram's website. How about that? Actually, the guy...
He had a pretty good week.
He did. He also owns that... What is that ball club
called? Yeah, but did you ever see any owner of any sports team seem less excited than this guy last night, as we speak, on the victory stand? He was It was just a wet fish. I don't know what this means for the Globe.
Well, it's because he's more excited about the Globe, which is an understated kind of a publication anyway, you know.
Guess.
But he's saying all the right things, you know, about being devoted to the journalism of the community and that kind of stuff. So time will tell. And I note that the folks in Worcester are unhappy that he hasn't made much of the fact that he owns that paper as well. So we'll have to keep our eyes on how that develops. Furthermore, although we haven't talked about this, you know, usually we huddle just a little bit before we start to do this show to talk about things. I note that there apparently is some interest we're hearing on the part of the Sage of Omaha investing in some of the Tribune papers. That is Warren Buffett, you know, has been on a buying
Buffett.
Spree.
Mm-hmm.
And now he's talking about perhaps being interested in Allentown, Pennsylvania, the Hartford Courant, and one of the papers in Virginia.
He seems to like the smaller papers, although Hartford is not a small paper, but it's not the Chicago Tribune or the LA
Boston
Times.
World, yeah.
Papers that still have some resilience where you can still draw upon, I think, community advertising support.
And both John Henry and Warren Buffett don't seem to have a problem fighting with any co-owners because they don't have any co-owners, but you saw what was going on in Philadelphia right now, which is just a mess.
Yes, we talked about that because Rosemary used to work for Bill Marimo, who is the editor in question, who was fired by his publisher and has basically said, I will be back.
He's sort of been fired. They can't decide, the owners can't decide what they want to do. And Marimo definitely doesn't want to do some of the things they want to do. His view has been always and always will be quality journalism will ensure the franchise.
But can you imagine, it happens to be a newspaper here, but can you imagine any business, and you're an employee or you're a customer, and you witness from the outside that the ownership of this company, a venerable company, is fighting with each other,
That's
and you
crazy.
Just throw up your hands and say, how can they be concentrating on their mission when they're busy fighting with each other?
Yeah.
It's very sad.
It is interesting, this trend that we're seeing of rich men, kind of iconoclastic men, buying big newspapers or middle-sized size newspapers. We have it in the Washington Post now and the Boston Globe. And boy, there have been worse ownership patterns than this.
That's absolutely right. And it is history repeating itself, since
absolutely.
This is how newspapers often got their start. People who wanted to have an impact in their communities. And it used to be considered sort of the beautiful circle that investment of money would lead to the rise of the power of the newspaper, which would lead to better journalism, which would in turn lead people to invest in it more. More readership leads to more power. And so it was a nice little
business
unit.
Model. It
business
worked.
Model, yeah.
For a long time.
Then folks borrowed and got greedy and decided that they would overextend their debt. And
I always blamed USA Today for this whole idea that newspapers had to produce huge profits all the time, even in times when the economy was not good. It had been cyclical before then, but Alan Neurath, the owner then, who started USA Today, a longtime Gannett official.
But the fact is, newspapers always did produce huge profits,
They did. Yeah. But this, if you'll recall, I mean, his idea was it's going to be this profit this year, and next year it will rise to this amount.
Yeah.
And that was the part that.
Yeah, and of course, for the first, I don't know how many number of years after its birth, it lost a lot of money.
Exactly.
And it was bleeding Gannett, and then the rest of Gannett was lifting the boat for USA. Now, I believe USA did reach a point where it started making a profit. I don't know where it is now in light of what's going on in the industry in general.
That's a good question. That set up that whole model, though, that newspapers should respond to the rules of Wall Street. It had never existed before.
By the way, I don't know that we discussed it here, and I didn't bring it, and I shouldn't even bring it up because I can't speak to it in detail.
Oh, we're accustomed to people speaking in the show without full knowledge.
Particularly sitting in this chair. But New York Magazine, within the last couple of weeks, had a story about Murdoch and what's going on at the New York Post. And I commend it certainly to you guys, but to anybody who's interested in that particular property and what's going on with them and their greater company and the business. And the gist of it seemed to be that the New York Post, which has lost money since Murdoch has owned it, a considerable amount of money, it now, some believe, is on the precipice of going out of business because the way they're structured now at News Corp, it is more vulnerable. And of course, Murdoch is in his 80s and is not going to go on forever. But I advise people interested in this sort of stuff to look at New York Magazine.
You have your homework assigned.
Yes.
All right.
That's right.
Excellent. Oh, one more thing on the business side of journalism before we move on, and that has to do with the aging of the readership for our print products, as well as for most of the broadcast journalism. Two facts in that regard. PBS NewsHour has lost 48% of its audience in the last 8 years. 8 years ago, the show had 2.5 million viewers a night. Now it's down to almost half that number. And of course, a lot of that is simply because of the aging of the public broadcasting, the aging of the news consumer in general, which does not give us great hope for the future. Notwithstanding that, there's a new magazine out on the newsstands now for people in the demographic that might refer to some of us here, women over age 50. There's a new magazine called...
I don't know what you're talking about.
it's called Closer, or is it called Closer? I don't know. It depends on what you're looking for here, pitching or intimacy. And so this is a new magazine that has as its first cover girl, get this, not Kim Kardashian or Kim West, whatever her name is, but Rhoda.
Valerie Harper
is there. She's 74 years old. Not exactly somebody who you would put on the cover of a magazine if you're aiming for the 20-somethings that a lot of advertising buyers go for. What do we do with the aging of information consumers? Is this a smart idea or not?
Well, there's a niche market. I mean, I don't know what the business model is. I would think that on the one hand, there is room for a publication and there would be interest in a publication like this because there is this euthanization of America and there's precious little for people of our generation to read. And so,
euthanization.
Yes, is that a real word?
Well, I hope it gets very close to euthanasia.
Like it would be very well, that too.
It would be damaging.
You know, whether it's a magazine like this or the multiplicity of websites that are developing, we may talk later about CBS is getting into an internet venture. There is just so much out there right now, and it's very exciting, but it's also very troubling, particularly those of us who are trying to make a living in this business, because the pie is just being split so much, you wonder how anybody is making any money. And by the way, I wonder on that McNeil Lehrer, that's what I was going to bring up, McNeil Lehrer on the NewsHour, they are no longer on the program, and I wonder how much of the loss of viewership has to do with that. And I also wonder if we start from the premise that PBS NewsHour is one of the refuges of hard news and studied and investigative news, that it can't make it, it's losing viewers, that what does that say about the appetite of consumers for real news, that they really do want this cut and paste kind of news that's on the other cable channels? And that's disappointing.
I have never understood why older readers, older viewers were not courted. They have as much money and less time to spend it in, so they'd be more likely to part with it. So I've never understood the business model's emphasis on that younger group. Why not go after them? This makes sense to me from a business sense, because we're still the baby boomers. That's who this magazine and others like it are aimed at. There's a lot of us, and I will read this, although I have to say I'm totally interested in Kim Kardashian. I hope they put her on too.
Is that right?
Are you really?
Yeah, I find that whole thing, I mean, the whole phenomena of the Kardashians is an interesting business and social phenomena. I do not put it down. I think it's pretty funny.
Well, there are plenty of places where you can find that information. I think the notion of closer
exactly.
or closer
get
is...
Get something different.
Yeah, I get a little
although the
there.
Mother, Kardashian, the Kardashian mother, certainly in this age demographic. So
yeah,
that,
you'd
that
have
would
to
be
say,
my suggestion.
What did she do?
Really?
How did this happen? You know, maybe the issue with the NewsHour is not that it's serious news and that that's what's turning people off. Maybe it is that the presentation is such that it doesn't attract people. Maybe there's a way to attract people to serious news without being boring. Is the show boring these days?
I just think it's straightforward and it's serious and it's for serious people and it presents points of view and it gives you news, and for people who are interested in that and who are willing to sit through it without having the clicker right in our hand,
yeah.
It's a very good news program. And I think the statistics would suggest that more and more people are not willing to put up with that kind of approach. And I think that what's particularly interesting about that is you hear these cries from people bemoaning the lack of this approach, and yet here's a program that does it, and it's losing viewership by 50%.
I think there's just lack of interest in news, and we have to face up to that. I spoke to a group yesterday of about 100 high school kids and asked some questions like, do you get your news from paper or online? You know, went through a Facebook, Twitter, blah. And there were spattering of hands at each choice, and yet the vast majority never raised their hand.
Mm-hmm.
And that means they're not getting news, and they're not missing it.
Frank Sesno, who used to be on CNN and now is a professor of some sort at, I believe, George Washington University in Washington, and he has been back on CNN occasionally filling in as the host of their media program on Sunday morning when Howard Kurtz left to go to Fox. And he did a piece that he taped in his classroom, and he had 8 or 10 of his students at the table, and he basically asked, these are students who are interested in the media,
right,
who are going to college and specializing in the media, and he went around the room and asked them where they get their news. And to a man and woman, they said, I go to my cell phone and I look mm-hmm. at the mobile, and that's
yep.
The first thing I do is go to here, or here. Now, the good news for newspaper companies is that several of them cited going to newspaper sites. But by and large, these are people who you would think if any young people would buy newspapers, this would
be
them. They don't
do that. Suggests that we really need to focus on distribution via social media, which I think your company is very big on this, and we're trying to do this better also. I think one of the things that is problematic for a program like the NewsHour, and certainly affects newspapers, is just the consumption habits are such that they are derived from the fact that we have limited attention span, that we now have become so focused on immediate gratification and moving on to the next thing, that I'll bet we have people listening to this program who have slipped in and out of it while
several
we've been
times,
talking,
right,
because we're always looking for the next best thing or the next great thing. And so it does seem as though you have to be quick, get people's attention, and if you want to get somebody into a deep read, because people do still read. People will pick up a book or they will read a long piece of journalism if it really is compelling. But you have to figure out a way to give it to them and give them, I think, the kind of presentation that the now legendary New York Times sports piece Snowfall about the Avalanche did, that you have to give them not only a great read, but also video to accompany it and sound and little interstitials such that you can reach the short attention span of today's consumers.
But will that methodology produce informed people in this country? Are we not? I mean, even as at the same time that we, you and I, are doing that at our publications because we know we must to survive, I would venture to say that both of us sort of wish it was the other way.
It's hard to explain why you should care about the debt limit in that kind of a story. Yeah. It's one thing to describe an avalanche and have a great narrative, mm-hmm. but it is hard to get serious journalism or to talk about a debt crisis. You know, those are just difficult issues. But we've always had to contend, haven't we, with the ice cream versus broccoli notion, with giving people important news versus giving them what's fun and attractive. So it's just a challenge.
I'm not even sure we have it down in schools where we're supposed to be educating. Textbooks are not widely read. Presentations and classes are considered boring and passe now, out of date. How to present information is a problem way beyond just the media.
Do all of your students carry iPads or tablets of some kind?
The cell phone is more commonplace, but iPads are common, so are small. The
mini tablets.
Yeah, mm-hmm. the mini mm-hmm. tablets and laptops that they'll bring in. But the cell phone, the smartphone is, that's the device.
We're unveiling a new mobile site that is, we will be reformatting so that we can better reach people on mobile. And this is, I think, the second new mobile site in 2 years. I mean, we have to just keep updating it to make it better and better, because it is, it's really the way that you have to reach people going forward. And we're also going to be adopting a new video format for our staff to shoot so that we can actually present more video. You know, one of the interesting things is that for years we've been saying, well, we have to put more video into our presentation. And the fact is, consumers haven't really been demanding it. 7 or 8 years ago, I came back from a conference and said, I want everybody in the newsroom to get video training. Everybody, I mean, everybody in the newsroom. I was wrong, because it hasn't been what people wanted. And I think your company, Ira, was really pushing forward.
Well, we have. In fact, we've evolved 2 or 3 times. We're now very big into this video called Tout, which is a 45-second video, as opposed to Vine, which is the 6-second video. As opposed to what we were initially doing, which was more of a long-form video. And Tout seems to be the balance we're striking. But I agree with you. But at the same time, I think you have to look at the video on websites and on mobile devices as part of a total package to try to have a number of things that are going to generate reader engagement and to keep people on your sites longer. I think what frustrates somebody like me, who is in sort of in the netherworld, I had retired, I was out of the business 6 weeks, now I'm back in at least temporarily, is that I read a press release from our CEO, because our company had struck an agreement with an advertising or page makeup venture. I don't even remember what it was. And he used phrases in the press release that were unfamiliar to me. And they were, you know, in the old days, we might say, oh, I don't know, pick an old newspaper phrase, and the three of us would immediately
30.
Know what it means. Yeah. But he was using modern day language that I thought I was pretty much up on. And I didn't know. I had to ask somebody, what does this mean? So it's just evolving faster than we can do it.
Yeah. Wow. If you're just joining us, it's The Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. Ira Fussfeld, publisher of the Daily Freeman in Kingston, New York. Rosemary Arameo, investigative journalist and professor at UAlbany. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. I've just read what I think is a pretty important paper written by Kelly McBride, who heads the ethics program at the Poynter Institute in Florida. It has to do with what is often reported in the media, which we've heard so much about. You know, bullying is a term that has just become ubiquitous. My goodness. Everybody claims that there is bullying going on. It started with kids being bullied in schools, and then it's bullying in politics, and it seemed to become one of the words that I think maybe we should just strike from the lexicon for just a while to get over the virus. But one of the important point that Kelly has pointed out here is that, notwithstanding the fact that journalists talk right all the time about young people committing suicide as a result of bullying in the schools, she reports, there is no scientific evidence that bullying causes suicide, none at all. She says lots of teenagers get bullied. Between 1 in 4 and 1 in 3 teenagers report being bullied in real life. Fewer report being bullied online. But among the people who commit suicide, researchers have found no good data indicating that they've been bullied. It's just an interesting point, because it is a narrative that you see all the time in the media. And I think it probably comes, as most of our problems do in journalism, from a lack of deep reporting, of failing to push to get that extra nuance. It is very easy for a law enforcement official to say this person was bullied and that's why this suicide occurred, and for us to buy into that narrative. And it is imperative, I think, for journalists to look beyond that.
Well, I'll accept the report because I'm not an expert in it. But on the other hand, doesn't it stand to reason? I mean, bullying is not new. We all experienced it when we were kids. But that the social media aspect of it today adds a new element in that when we were bullied in the schools, we could go home and we would be safe from that bullying. And now these kids are coming home and the bullying is continuing on Facebook or on Twitter or wherever it is on social media. And I just wonder if there's an accumulation of bullying that suggests it is a factor. But that all said, if the report says otherwise, then they've done more research into it than I have.
I'm interested to hear you say you've considered this an important report. I tend to look with suspicion at anything that comes out of the ethics police that are at the Poynter Institute. And in this case, bullying has been underreported, and the press came back, and you're probably right, they've overdone it. But there is, or there may be, some connection, just because science hasn't shown it yet. And it seems like, don't make that connection. I really object to that. It's like not reporting that shark attacks are happening because it makes it seem like there are more shark attacks happening. I'm reporting on shark attacks. I'm going to report on bullying. The real problem may be that journalists undercover suicide, and that has come from years of advice that if we cover it, we're somehow glorifying and encouraging copycats, which I've never believed, because if a suicide happens in a school, they don't need to read about it in the newspaper. We've just been talking about how they don't read newspapers anyway. Mm-hmm. They know about it from word of mouth. So if there's any copycat going on, it's going on because of what happens there. So deeper coverage of suicide is clearly called for, has been for years. And bullying may be part of that. It may be a symptom. We know this report says bullying does not cause suicide. We don't really know what causes suicide. It's a mental illness.
It doesn't say it doesn't. Yeah. It says we don't. There's no evidence that it does.
Yeah.
When we allow police to say that, it is, I think, the difficult point. And whenever you write about suicide, you're right. Whenever you write about suicide, speaking of the police, we try very hard, especially when writing about youth suicide, to follow guidelines that are set down by this not-for-profit organization. And we still get scolded every time, no matter how hard we try.
A young person taking a life is an important story that deserves lots of press coverage. Why did that happen? What can we do to prevent it? We should be doing this in depth. And for years, we have not. All the years I was in newspapers, we were not
allowed
to cover.
Guys, do
this.
Was it your experience when you were on newspapers and Greg's currently at our shop? If someone commits suicide, the name is not reported and the story may not even be reported unless the suicide takes place in a public place or it involves public resources to come in.
Exactly.
I mean, that's pretty much standard procedure.
It's one of those stupid ethics rules where we don't cover it unless we really want to cover it, and then we come up with a reason to do it.
Yeah, and then when you have the obituary of the young person, the code is died suddenly, which more often than not could mean that there was a suicide
especially if
involved.
It's a young person.
Yeah, yeah. But are we saying that we should be revisiting? Would you advocate every suicide
absolutely.
Be reported by name?
I think every death, every homicide, every suicide is worthy of coverage.
The difficulty is, I think, when you don't push hard enough on officialdom, and this is, of course, throughout journalism. When I was a reporter, I ended up getting engaged in a big project involving a homicide involving teenagers in this beautiful North Shore Long Island community of Northport.
Yes.
The project that resulted was called A Shared Secret because teenagers were led to the side of the body and they kept this secret for a long time that there had been, and this kid just vanished. You know, where is he? He had been killed by friends. And the homicide squad captain, when this was finally uncovered, announced this was Satanism. This teenager killed this guy in the throes of Satanism. He thought that he was hearing Satan. Well, in fact, it was actually drugs. Our reporting led us to finally find out that the kid was high on PCP, what they used to call angel dust, and it led to violence, and one thing led to another. He thought that his friend had stolen some drug from him. So our reporting lanced that notion of Satanism, and I think that's sometimes just what we need to do. We need to just, as always, attach a questioning eye to whatever officialdom offers us.
Yeah. Now, that's a good lesson to take away from this study, to not accept any official version and to do more in-depth reporting, to report all the aspects of the story.
And for people to read that in-depth reporting in their local
there you go.
Online or in print. And go back and watch PBS. Give it another shot.
right. Thanks for joining us this week on
Nicely
the Media Project. How about that?
Drafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery. She wanted money to buy a new fur coat. To get insurance, she employed skullduggery. She up and cut her husband's only throat. She chopped him into fragments, she stuffed him in a trunk. She shipped it all back yonder to her uncle in Podunk. Now newspapermen meet such interesting people. It must have startled poor old Sadie's unk. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, city desk, hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you, Christ.